Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch good, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She a nigga. That nigga hurting himself. You from Nuke State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout in Coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087, this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Today, our topic is Floyd education and income statistics. Floyd education and income statistics. Floyd is spelled S-L-O-Y-D. Once again, Floyd is spelled S-L-O-Y-D. And we're going to talk about Floyd education and income statistics. Now, to follow me or to closely follow me, if you're not on our Blog Talk page on, Blog Talk Radio, and we're listed as DIY Housing TV on Blog Talk, or It's My House on Blog Talk or Solar Landlord, but one of those three links. Or you can go, it might be easier to go to our Facebook page, which is DIY Housing TV. Go to Facebook and then type into the Facebook search engine, DIY Housing TV on Facebook. And then I've got a link there, the very first link, which we'll be talking about, Floyd education. There's some statistics there. So we're going to go over those statistics, and we're going to, you know, tell you what Floyd education is. How it can basically help uplift not only households, but communities or even nations. So let's see. All right, once again, that's on. I'm trying to cue up the next audio here. But as we do this next motivational piece, we will, that's where we'll be. So I'm giving you a little bit of heads up on it. Barrel through all these audios. Okay. All right, so. We shall be back in 2 minutes. Now, just take this 2 minutes to do what you got to do. But we're going to go right after this 2 minute interlude. We'll go to DIY Housing TV on Facebook, and then it's the first link. We're going to go through that, and we'll that includes Floyd education and income statistics. The income statistics is one of those links on there.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, so here's some of the things we're going to go over today. The primary topic headline is Sloyd Education. That's spelled, Sloyd is spelled S-L-O-Y-D. Sloyd Education, income statistics. So some of the things we're going to touch on is Sloyd Education, education in Finland, which, depending on what stats you look at, Finland, some people say that Finland has the best educational system on the planet. At least, you know, with secondary school, royal jelly education, hands-on skills training versus academic and IT training, Amish education, and we may as well say Amish and Mennonite education, income by ethnic groups. That's what we're going to go over momentarily, income by ethnic groups, particularly here in the United States. All right. And we have some statistics. We got a chart of that. And if you go to our Facebook page, which I instructed people to do prior to the interlude, is go to DIY Housing TV on Facebook. Scroll down to the first thing and link, and it'll be some pictures. But that chart in there, we're about to go through that momentarily. Income by ethnic groups. Floyd schools, off-the-grid house building schools, off-the-grid building trades, IKEA, which is in Scandinavia, Finland, Scandinavia, convenience store couples, and Amish cars. Okay, so, all right, so let's roll over to our Facebook page. And if you don't have Facebook, that's fine. But okay, here we go. And it's the first, well, you know what? All right, hold on. Let me go to the statistics first. So we got, now this United States based. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Now hold it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. All right. In this chart, on this chart, there's 17 ethnic groups. All right, so I'm going to start with number one, and I'm going down to, from 1 to 17. All right. So here we go. In the United States, Indian Americans, not Native Americans, but Indian Americans, people from India, are number one when it comes to median household incomes in the United States. That number is 100,500 median income household. So Indians are number one in the USA. Number two, Filipino Americans, 83,300 coming in at number three. Taiwanese Americans, $82,500. Number four, Sri Lankan Americans, $74,600. Coming in at number five, Japanese Americans, $72,300. Number six, Malaysian Americans, $70,300. Coming in at number seven, Chinese Americans, $69,100. Coming in at number eight, Pakistani Americans, $66,200. Notice that each and every one of these countries, ethnic groups, are Asian-based Asian groups right here in the United States, and they totally obliterate, in my opinion, statistically, when at least when it comes to household income, the idea of the concept, or even I would call it the myth of white supremacy. Coming in at number nine are white Americans. They average $59,900. That's the median income. So you have eight other ethnic groups in the United States that make more than the average white American household. Coming in after white Americans or Korean Americans at $59,200, then Indonesian Americans have $57,500. The average American, that's everybody, earns $56,200 a year. Thai Americans, $55,000 even. Bangladesh Americans, $50,000 even. Nepali Americans, $43,500. Hispanic Latino Americans, $43,000 a year. And African Americans coming at number 17 at $35,000 a year. That's the median income. Now, percentage of the population, and this is United States based with a bachelor's degree, coming in at number one, Indian Americans, coming in at number one with 70%. 70% of Indian Americans in the United States have a bachelor's degree. Coming in at number two, Korean Americans, 53% have a bachelor's degree. Coming in at number, three, Chinese Americans at 51%. Coming in at number four, Filipino Americans, 47% have a bachelor's degree. Coming in at number five, Japanese Americans, 46%. The average of 28% of the American population, adults at least, have the bachelor's degree. Now, what's that got to do with slurred education? Well, just 24 hours ago, I didn't know nothing about slurred education, at least the term. And okay. You can go on Wikipedia because that's where I'm at right now, S-L-O-Y-D. SLOID, also known as Educational SLOID, is a system of handicraft-based education started by UNOC, in Finland in 1865. All right. That's interesting, you're 1865. Now, as I read through this, okay, somebody in Sweden or Scandinavia coined it, all right, because what I'll be reading is, depending on the culture, they call it something different. But they really culturally they've included in their culture, right? This system was further refined and promoted worldwide as was taught in the United States until the early 20th century. It is still taught as a compulsory subject in Denmark, Sweden, and in Norwegian schools. Now, to really simplify stuff, is shop class, it's woodworking. But they include it, it's immersed in every other topic that they teach in school. And I thought that was pretty interesting. All right, Sloyd differed from many other forms of manual training. And Booker T. Washington, the term that he would use would be industrial education. All right, Booker T. Washington basically said, you know, in addition to academic, you know, you need to be trained in the industrial arts or industrial education. That way, you know, you can definitely make an income. You know, making furniture, sewing clothes, baking pies, building buildings, making bricks, making nails, what have you. Sloyd different from other forms of manual training and adherence to a set of distinct principles. They were that instruction could move from the known to the unknown, from easy to more difficult, from simple to more complicated. Sloyd should be practical in nature and build a relationship between the home and the school. Sloyd unlocked his major rival, the Russian system, promoted by Victor Delavos, was designed in general rather than for vocational education. Now, what's the Russian system all about? Education in Russia. In Russia, the state of, you know, and I got a friend of mine who lived in Russia for 7 years. I got to bring him on here. Hopefully tomorrow. But, and let me bookmark this. Now, let me break it down simply. Okay. You have quite a few homeless people in the United States. The United States is not the only place, but, you know, for the sake of this conversation, the United States. Sloyd education, which is a Finnish term, okay, would be the same as industrial education as Booker T. Washington. He would term it that way. The Amish, they go academically grade 1 through 8. So the common denominator with Sloyd education, the Amish stopping at grade 8. And what did they do for, you know, what would they have done for grades 9 and 11? Well, in the Amish and men in the community, in the Hutterite community, what they do is they start learning the family and or the community business. Hutterites are just like the Amish and Mennonite, except the Amish and the Mennonite, what they do is it's the entrepreneurial on the individual household basis. The family could have a bakery, could have a farm, could have a thrift shop, could have a furniture store. They could build, you know, houses, tiny houses, barns, gates, fences, what have you. You know, whatever they want to do. All right, farming, what have you. All right. In a Hutterite community, all right, it's more community-based. Everybody owns everything. The Amish family might go out and buy 5, 10, 20, 40 acres of land, maybe 100 acres of land, and the Mennonites might do the same thing. Whereas, and the Mennonites, you know, they'll use a smartphone or computer or tablet, all right? Amish come and go, although the Amish do use solar. A lot of them are using solar energy, and the youngins they're replacing the horse and buggy with electric bikes, all right? The Hutterites, which is similar to both of those because they all are all interconnected. The Hutterites, they don't in the individual household, it's the whole community, and they might go out and buy 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 acres of land. It's all community owned. Everybody's got a job. And in all three communities, there's no welfare. There's no social services. All right. They operate on social capital. So now let's go back to the Before I go to that, all right. So Sloyd, and like I said, that includes Russian, and I'm going to bring a guy on hopefully tomorrow or something like that or by the end of the week. We're going to talk about Sloyd education, Russian education, and education right here in the United States. All right. Going back to our blog talk notes, which picks back up on this. Because in other countries, they practice sort of the same thing. They just in certain countries. But if we can take a snapshot of right here in the United States, if we take a look at Amish community, Mennonite to a certain degree, but Amish hardcore, some of the Arab communities in the United States, now I'm going by my personal experience. Up in Detroit, because I lived up there for a bit, up in Detroit, you have a lot of Arabs who own businesses. They own gas stations up in Detroit. They own mechanic shops in Detroit. Convenience stores in Detroit are called stores. Okay. Their family owned rent. Okay. And were employed. Chinese food, Asian food, had a lock on that. But the gas stations, the automobile gas, party stores, and or convenience stores, basically, were family-based business. All right, so if you look at the highest, the income that I named, but if you break down household income, the United States. Okay, I got booted out. I got booted off my own show. All right, let me go back to where I was. I'm waiting for my phone to repopulate here. Okay, now, like I say, in Detroit, you see they're visible, very visible. You have a lot of Arab, and they're from Asia. You know, Arabia is in the Middle East, which is Asia, West Asia. But we break down the top families, which are basically, I mean, Asian countries dominate. But in this country, how much time do households, dominate? But look at some common denominators. A lot of them would have what I would call, although they would call it something different. You can call it industrial-based education, entrepreneurial-based education. If it's Scandinavian or Swedish-based education, I don't know what we would call it in Asia, but They was very entrepreneurial. But that's what they did. And that's, I mean, you can see, and let's look at some of the common denominators. If we take a look at the Arab community, the Arab entrepreneurial community, which operates out of predominantly Black Michigan, or any urban area, or Asians who own the Chinese food carryout, the dry cleaner, the gas station, the auto body shop, here's some of the common denominators. Number one, they're family-based businesses. And I'll just speak for myself. I got in my house in Washington, D.C., and that neighborhood, by a Korean family, you see at least three generations of that Korean family in that store 6 days a week. You see the grandparents, or at least one grandparent. You see the parents, and you see the teens and or toddlers. They come to the husband and the wife or the family. They wherever they come, they don't live in the neighborhood now. Whatever the neighborhood they live in, they come to work to get their family-owned business together. They put in their 8 or more hours a day in the family business together. And they might be taking in $20,000, $25,000 a day. Legally. In plain sight. Anybody can do. They lock up the family business, whatever that might be, today. It could be a dollar store. It could be a restaurant. It could be a liquor store. It could be a dry cleaner. It could be a gas station. It could be an auto mechanic shop. I'm talking about what I've seen with my own eyes, and I've been crazy now, God knows how many times. They lock up the shop, and they go back home together. I would say that is the number one common denominator for their success, and they have a super low divorce rate, and that's why those household incomes are so high. The average Chinese carryout restaurant in the United States makes $1.1 million a year. That's just a carryout. It's not even sit down. You can't even sit down and eat. You order your egg foo young, egg rolls, whatever. Pick it up and go. But it's a family-based operation. So now their story, Lord education, in an Amish community, they might call it, they call it woodworking. They don't call it Sloyd. Sloyd is a Finnish term. All right. But, you know, they've coined the term. They brought it to the United States. It caught on. Now we call it, in the United States, we call it shop class. All right? Now, the common denominator with most of your homeless people are people that are struggling to pay the rent or facing foreclosure or evictions or something like that. The common denominator, I tell you, there are two common denominators. Number one, they don't know how to build a house. Number two, they know little or nothing about woodworking. Booker T. Washington, he coined it as industrial education. He said you need to have that as well as academic education. The top ethnic groups in the United States, and once again, we have that listed, and these are statistics that come from the United States Census Bureau. If you go to our Facebook page, once again, which is DIY Housing TV, that's something you might want to consider. Model what they do. It's not rocket science. If you're single out there, I would recommend, and you want to hook up with anybody, hook with somebody that you're on the same page with them, where y'all can start a business together, and do it, and just model what these high-income ethnic groups have done in this country, go to work together. Now, these days, you know, you can go to the beach together and work together. You know, you can stay at home and work at the kitchen table or dining room table or, you know what, basement, whatever you got in your house, and have a family business that way. So, you know, with an internet connection, you got a lot more options. But not everything, you know, you can do online. Like the Amish, you know, if they have a family-based business, which is a bakery, you can't do that online. I mean, you can market it online. But, you know, we talked about that. Matter of fact, I'm not going to play the audio of her day, but Mignon Francois, a black woman from New Orleans, Louisiana. I've told this, shared this story with you several times. For her, her Sloyd, or Sloyd education, was she took her grandmother's recipe for cupcakes. Now, once again, this is a backstory. This woman's electricity was shut off. Her water was shut off. She and her husband at the time, with seven children and a baby with one of those seven children, they didn't have no electricity or water. But what she did have is her grandmother's recipe, and she took the $5 that she had in her pocket, which she was supposed to use for dinner that night, took that, bought some cupcake materials or whatever to make cupcakes, and made $60 the first day. So her Sloyd education was making those. She took grandma's cupcake recipe. She didn't even know how to make cupcakes. Two of her daughters had to help her out with that. But since then, she's taken that $5. I mean, the first week, $5 into $60 day one. Then by the end of the week, the $5 had morphed into $600. She kept on doing that until she was able to get the electricity cut back on, the water cut back on, and get the house out of foreclosure. They still own the house to this day. They've expanded to Nashville, Tennessee. The name of her business is called Cupcake Collection. We're working on getting her on here, our guest interview with us. So for the sake of this conversation here today, well, rant, because I'm not talking to anybody right now. For the sake of this rant today, okay, once again, take a look at the median household incomes, which we placed on our Facebook page, which is on DIY Housing TV, and there's 17 ethnic groups there based in the United States. And look at the common denominators. The next time you go out and to a Chinese restaurant or a station or a place that's a foreign-owned business, look at, like, once again. Let's jump over to Africa. There's a 7-Eleven at one of my houses, near one of my houses, and they're Ethiopians. It's a family-based business. Everybody employed at this Ethiopian-owned 7-Eleven, they're Ethiopians. Now, they might hire some neighborhood person that's American just to keep pace with the, you know, little local civic association. But mom and dad come to work from wherever they live at in the D.C. metro area, DMV as they call it. They come to work together with the kids. The family works the business during hours, and then other family members take it over overnight. They're employing family members 24/7, 365. If there's ever a glaring secret for success, that's it. They're not work. They don't have jobs making somebody else's rich. They're working together as a family, making everybody in the family rich.
say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
I want to tell you about the first time. I was 21 years old and I saw $6 million of cash right in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That's what $6 million looks like? Insane. How the hell can I get this kind of money one day? And the guy who had the $6 million was a Jewish businessman who owned dealerships in San Fernando Valley area. And he gave me an advice at 21 that completely changed the way I do business till today. By the way, if you get value from today's message, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. Here's what this Jewish businessman told me. I said, how is it possible you got this much money and you're in your mid-30s, $6 million cash? He says, Patrick, there's one thing you need to know about Jews. I said, what's that? When one makes money, five make money. I said, what? He says, when one of us makes money in a business, five other Jews make money because we like to make money in groups. I said, so what's the benefit of that? He said, everybody keeps doing business together. He says, too many people, ethnicities, nationalities, cultures, backgrounds, they just want to be the one making money. They don't want anybody else around them making money. And then eventually they wonder, how come nobody wants to go into business with me? Because when you make money, nobody else makes money. So ask yourself the question. Number one, the person you're working for, does he make money and do you make money? And number two, the people that work with you, who report to you, if they give their best, do they also make good money the way you're making money? If the answer is yes, you're in a great place. Go do your part, and eventually you'll make your money like that Jewish mentor shared with this 21-year-old 24 years ago, 23 years ago. If you got value from this video, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. And if you've never watched the video, 20 Rules of Money, How Actually Money Works, click here to watch the video, 20 Rules of Money. Take care, everybody.
All right, so if we look at the examples of that we, you know, the statistics from the United States Census Bureau, it's not mine. All right, the highest income, I mean, ethnic groups by median household income All right. You have a lot of those families that, you know, it's just not a Jewish thing, okay? It can be practiced in any household, any culture, any class, religion, skin tone, race, whatever. Is that, I mean, let's look at it. The Amish, when one Amish person makes money in the family business, all the family members in that Amish family business make money together. Okay. There's a map. I didn't list any today, but you can look them up on your own. Type in any search engine, Amish communities map. Amish communities map. And you'll see there are hundreds of them. And, you know, in North America. If you type in Mennonite, Amish communities globally, you know, there's a lot of them around, including Africa and many countries in North America. One place, and I want to do a road to this place, Yoder, that's Y-O-D-E-R, Yoder, Kansas. I don't even think 200 people live in Yoder, Kansas. It's an Amish, primarily an Amish, might have some Mennonites in there, but primarily an Amish Mennonite community where basically every family has a business. And although they're Amish, they're not Jewish, but the same principle applies. When one, they like making money together as a family. What a concept. They're not going out and getting a job at McDonald's, although there's nothing wrong with that. But they're not going to, they're not getting a job at McDonald's. Because when you go get a job at, wait, one of your kids or grandkids goes get a job at McDonald's, they're making somebody at McDonald's rich. They're not making their family rich. And on top of that, if you're the only one of your family members working at McDonald's, the Subway, or Giant, Safeway, Publix, the local car dealership, the government job, or what have you, you're not empowering your own family as much as you could be. So these are some, like, really basic common denominators. And, like, say, the Sloy education thing, ecomorphism, I mean, you know, it could be now – from a Scandinavian point of view, it's, you know, woodworking education, which incorporates into practical use in other subjects that you might learn in school, as well as, you know, in woodworking class, oh, what did you learn today? Well, I learned how to make a barn. Okay. And then you turn that barn, that skill into, well, you know, I make barns for a living. Or, well, we built a house today, so we can rent the house out for Airbnb. If you look at those 17 ethnic groups, all right, particularly the top 7, 8, or 9, at least like 7, 8, You won't see many of those people homeless in this country, at least. Now, different other parts of the world, you know, it's a different story, but I'm just saying that those statistics are based on what we have here in the United States. That comes from the United States Census Bureau. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines real quick. I'm done with my rant for today. 309 area code, your mic is open.
Good morning, LA. I don't know about a rant.
Good morning, sir.
I actually was the first time I got to watch the podcast. I was just sitting, looking at my phone and there at my screen, but I don't have your little podcast going showing me the videos that are happening. And as I was looking at the slideshow for the slob education, that was, you know, I remember shop, you know, when I was in school, which here I am 50.
Shop is the American name for slob education. So you've been educated in that from way back.
Yeah, yeah. That was what I was getting. It wasn't called slob, but it was shop. And right now, they've got another name for it. I had it right on the tip of my tongue a second ago, but they do have another name for it now. And it's,
well, I guess in some places you might call it over here vocational training. Vocational training. I know in D.C. there was a place called Phelps. It was originally called Phelps Vocational School. Then they changed it to Phelps Career Center, but I don't know if they changed it back to the original name. But essentially, it gives you it's learning how to make something. Now, it could be at that particular school. I don't know what they have now. But when I was there, they had auto body for people that wanted to know something about how to repair cars after accidents or had dents and dings. They had masonry classes, electrical wiring. I don't recall any carpentry classes over there, at least when I was there. But you can go to many community colleges now and take a carpentry class or a woodworker. I mean, everything is available now. For those who want to do it.
Correct.
I think it's good to know the basics of how to build something, like a house, even if it's a daughter, because, A, you can just use it for your own personal use, or if you, need to earn some money, you can, if you want to build a birdhouse or a barn or something, you can relatively get a job quite quickly.
I was going to say, I spoke with a director of a vocational center. He's over 20 high or 20 different school districts.
Right.
And he told me straight up, he says, we are not teaching these children what they need to know. When I made my presentation to him, he said, I need two pieces of paper. I need one on what the kids are going to be doing, and then I need two, what are my instructors going to do so they don't lose their job? And the thing is the instructors can teach the in-school parts, let you see it on paper on how things work and why they work and, show you the strengths of what these things are and all that. Because that's what the snow loads and all that do. That's when they want to start playing with the AutoCAD. And he loved it because it actually gave them a curriculum that they don't have now. And if we utilize these vocational centers that are already in all of our high schools in every community across the country, and they are not doing anything to be productive to the community or themselves, because they're showing them how to frame a door. Now, that's it. How to frame a door. I was like, you guys are kidding me. That's your construction, class? So they were all in about letting the kids learn this. So, I think that would be a key thing to, revamp what's going on. And now, the reason that school changed it from career or from vocational to career, they probably did not change it back because I just told you, the vocational system was telling me that they were failing the kids. They was not educating them the way they should be. So there's a stigma there, just as well as there is with the word homeless. So I like housing challenge and let's do that housing challenge. But I do know that, school systems are open to suggestions and they, especially if it doesn't really cost them any money. And by working the program through them, it wouldn't cost them money because the program could afford to pay for itself. And
right.
We don't have to pay the instructor. They're already being paid.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I know when I was at a career or vocational school in D.C., this is in the early 80s, they had problems of finding teachers to hire because apparently they weren't paying enough. I wasn't in the building trades at that time. And the teachers that they did have, the shop teachers that they did have, mostly were retired people. So they were working there basically to get out of the house for a few hours a day or supplement their income. I don't know if that's changed around the country since then because it's been a while. But you do have, and this is why I like YouTube as a barometer, you do have a lot of people learning new skills. It could be from, learning how to convert a car into a tiny house, or a van into a tiny house, or a school bus into a tiny house, cargo containers, try to turn that into housing or off complex, or growing food, or there's a lot of DIYers and hobbyists on YouTube. People that are, they're learning hands-on skills.
That's right.
So that's where, and as they're learning a lot of these hands-on skills, if you learn how to build your own house to live in, why do you never need you don't need an FHA mortgage, a VA mortgage, or a bank loan? Because you've built it debt free. So, like I say, they're uploading videos on the clock.
Even if you had to get a small loan,
mm-hmm.
small loan comes with a small payment. Now, you don't
right.
go and make the minimum payment. If you get that loan, one of the ways, a QA like buying a car, they'll set up your payments, but when they say annual APR, that means every 4 months, this thing is adding interest to your account. And it's on the balance, the principal balance. And if you take that principal balance and pay two extra payments, so say you had a $100 payment over the next 15 years that needed to be paid. By taking two extra $100, putting it toward the principal of the loan, you will eliminate years. Do that 2 years for 2 years, and you'll eliminate, I'm wanting to say it's 5 years off of the loan.
Yeah,
just
well,
by making
that
extra payment.
You're talking about that time my mother, the first house she bought was for $19,500 or $19,900 anyway, with a mortgage on it. I don't know how much she put on the down payment. She made two house payments a month. It didn't strain her, lifestyle or nothing like that. She made two house payments a month. Now, this is when house notes were like $200 a month, okay? And you know what? In some areas, you know, $200 or house note for that month. But, it's not going to be in Manhattan, New York. But there are places that you can still pull it off. But she made two house payments a month, so the second payment that she made was essentially all that went to principal. And that basically just, she had that house paid off pretty quick.
Yeah, it eliminates the whole discussion of a mortgage. And they don't want you to do it. They'd rather you come in and make payments ahead and make you feel like, oh, I don't have to make a payment for 3 or 4 months. Thing is, you're committed to the payment, so make the payment. Now, if you have anything over that payment, put it toward the principal, and you will eliminate payments. And it just, mainly your payments, when they base that over a 30-year period, you're paying 4 to 5 times what you originally borrowed. So if you're going to pay the multiplicity, come on now, build the mansion. Just build it one room at a time. That's a good strategy too.
That's a very good strategy too, Chris. You're absolutely right. I know like in Jamaica, now this is a cultural thing down there with a lot, maybe not all, or the West Indies, they build a house out of pocket. They build it one room, whatever their budget is, if they got enough to build it one room at a time, they build it one room at a time. Or if they got enough money for two rooms, they'll knock it out that way. But that's another good strategy.
You know, I this weekend I was playing with the artificial intelligence with the GPT, and we have put a manual together that I'm getting ready to publish it. I think I might have sent you a little workbook or a guide that will bring you into this other thing. But if you want to take a look at that in your text, there should be a very long text from me.
Oh, wait a minute.
It'll look like a short text, but you open it up and it turns into a document. What it was is when I was done, I turned around and took all of it and put it inside the AI and asked it if it would work. And it said yes. So in this manual, it basically shows us how and the way we can grow in so many ways, but what it'll do for every human on Earth. It will change mankind. It even said that it would make sure that tomorrow, you know how I say, let's do something today to make tomorrow better so that yesterday never happens again? It actually said, AI told us that it will never be the same. But what the key core thing, what it took to give peace on Earth, and put through AI was by asking it, was housing. And that was the way I started it out. I went with housing every person on Earth. How would that change mankind? And it when I was done with everything that we put together there, it shows peace on Earth right there in your hands. And it shows every person not equally having all the same money. That's not the way it shows.
Okay.
But it shows you how governments can do initiatives, what you as a person can do to help in an initiative. It talks about the creativity that everyone is. It talks about how it encourages every aspect of the human being and the mental aspects behind it all, getting all the services, all the things that we talked about, everything is in there. So I'm looking forward to having that published on Amazon here in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, I'll look for it in my notes from you, my text from you. Well, when I couldn't find it, that's why I sent you the text. Unless it was way back. I remember the IRC thing you sent, Appendix Q or whatever.
Yeah, I think this one started out with just, it says humanity. Oh, yeah, it's right there. I sent it yesterday at 10:35 a.m.
Hmm. Right,
on the
let
one
me go back.
Humanity.
Okay, wait a minute. Yesterday, which is... All right, today... All right, the last thing I got from you was Thursday.
Really?
No, hold on. Thursday at 3 p.m.
Let me do this real quick.
I didn't leave anything.
Give me your email.
Email. Did you send it by email?
No, I'm going to send it to you right now on email. What is it?
Oh, okay. Do you have my email address?
I don't know. I might start telling it to you and I'm going to type it in.
I just texted it to you.
Oh, you just texted it to me. All right, perfect.
Yeah, I just texted it.
All right. Now I'm going to – all right, you'll have this thing in just a second.
I remember when you sent Appendix Q.
Right. Now, this was just it was a very long text. It's why it might not have went through. You might not have received it but I just sent you an email, so you should have that.
They got things from you from back in January. Even last December. Let's see. Yeah, I got stuff from you going back to November. Okay, in text form. Okay.
Yeah, back in November.
All right, let's see.
I was going to say, I think we're about 6 months into this thing right now.
Right. So, all right. Yeah, I got it in an email just now. I got it.
That's the short version, of course. That's the introduction or the intro to the big one.
Okay, well, I'll read over this afternoon. And I already put it.
No, if you go all the way, if you started with just the what that thing says in the very first of it, just like the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And then scroll all the way to the bottom and read the last paragraph. There's a lot in between.
Right.
But if you look at what starts it, you know, it's just here, right here in the beginning. Now, when I send you the next thing, it actually says, here's what to do first.
Okay.
And it tells you all the way through that thing, step by step, how an individual or a government or just an organization or a company, doesn't matter, if everybody can get involved, and it shows you how you can get involved. Shows you social equity. It shows you monetarily if you can't go social. If you can't do it, you know, hands-on, it just explains it. But it's, you know, it's very matter-of-fact. It's very everything there that we all would wish for. Every word that you could possibly think of that would be positive in your life is written right there. It would change every aspect of everything we ever thought of as human beings.
Okay.
So it was fun doing it.
All right, well, I'm going to get to that. And on that note, we're going to wrap it up a day, Chris, kind of early. So I can't get through that and take care of some other things I got on my platter for today. So on that note, we'll be back tomorrow. Everyone has a good day.